So the topic of today's talk is the poor relief system in 18th century and 19th century Bucks County. We will go a little bit into the 20th century. The poor relief system that was practiced in Bucks County was common to most of England and most of the English colonies, with some variations, essentially it called for the relief of the poor on the local level. In Bucks County, it was on the township level initially. Back in England, it was on the parish level. In other parts of the colonies where the Church of England was in charge, like Virginia, it was still down on the parish level, and I believe like church wardens were involved instead of secular government officials. And it all dates back basically to the Tudor era, starting with the collapse of medieval society. Certain things like the enclosure of public lands and the kind of privatization of lands and concentrating land wealth in smaller numbers of individuals, as well as population increase, which kind of shifted people away, forced people to kind of move looking for work as their family land holdings got smaller and smaller. Also industrialization kind of moved production out of the home and into larger workshops where someone was in charge of it all, and people working there kind of did it for hourly wages, and wage labor kind of arose as something that, instead of previously in earlier times, wage labor was something that young men did before they got married, basically. Some female servants as well, for a few years between childhood and kind of establishing your own household. You might be a wage laborer, but there was not a permanent class of wage laborers. And with the rise of a permanent class of wage laborers urbanization and people flying to cities to do work, you ended up with a class of permanent poor, which was not the case in earlier times. And so the first response was to punish people. the first laws related to the poor were about punishing vagabonds and beggars and people that were considered transient, calling for the hanging of repeated beggars and physical punishment for people that were considered to be vagrants. And later, the origins of the system that lasted for a long time after that kind of arose under Queen Elizabeth, late 1500s, early 1600s. They created a series of laws that kind of codified the poor relief system. The kind of gist of that was that people that lived within a parish were to be cared for by the people of that parish if they fell on hard times. So if they, got sick, couldn't care for themselves, the elderly, things along those lines, someone broke their leg and couldn't work, stuff like that, they would be cared for and provided with poor relief at the local level. Because it was at the local level, there ended up being all these squabbles over, if my parish is paying for this person, but they just moved here a week ago, it should be the other parish that they came from. And the result was that they ended up passing what was called the Settlement Act in, I believe it was 1662, that created the criteria by which people would be identified as a legal resident, quote, having settlement in that parish. And the same thing kind of got shipped over here. With Pennsylvania, basically that the system was adopted wholesale, very few changes, and really in the earliest county records and court records from the 1680s, you see people, going to the court and, begging for relief and having their children bound out as indentured servants because their husband died or what have you. Eventually they passed a few laws to kind of formalize it because, they, being a separate colony, they need to have their own laws. And in 1706, they kind of passed the first official laws in later years, they kind of formalized it. But basically, the way the system worked was that each township would appoint, on an annual basis, two officials called overseers of the poor, whose job it was to do this stuff. They would, identify cases of need. They would bring those cases to the two justices of the peace, which would then issue a determination as to whether they were deserving poor, whether they had legal status, whether they needed to be removed because they did not have legal status. Once if a person was approved, they would then provide the aid, and if they were determined not to be a legal resident, they were shipped out. It was the overseers of the poor's job to then physically relocate them. They also were tasked with indenturing out the children of the poor. In a case of temporary need, maybe not, but if it was someone that seemed pretty clear that the parents or often the widowed mother would be kind of perpetual poor herself and couldn't in any time in the near future support her child or children, the children would be bound out as indentured servants until they'd reach maturity, which for women would be 18 and men 21. The overseers of the poor would find a master, and they would be the kind of guardians that were signing off the kid to be indentured out. Again, you know, that's something you see in the record, court records all the way back in the 1680s and still into the, you know, the late 1800s, actually, as late as, I believe on the 1870 census for Buckingham, there were a couple girls that are listed as bound girl on the U.S. census as their relation to head of household. So it was something that was continued for a while. In terms of, you know, the actual relief that was provided, they provided food, they provided clothing, they paid people's rent, they provided medical care, they provided other necessaries such as firewood, which is obviously at that time was very important, you needed it to live, and they also paid for funeral expenses. And as it so happened, a lot of people needed a lot of help shortly before they died, and that was a lot of what they did. The records for these things, because they were like stored on the local level, they were administered by local people, there wasn't some county office where it all got stored, a lot of it wasn't saved. We are lucky because for Solbury, there happens to be a set of papers relating to the relief of the poor from the late 1700s, early 1800s that are in the John Ruckman papers over at the Mercer Museum. And we also have some poor books from Bucks County, which were basically account books kept by the overseers of the poor. And we have those for a few places, including Wrightstown and Warminster, which I'll be giving examples from. So to give you an idea of what that relief system looked like and how the, you know, the poor were aided by the system, we'll give you some examples. So starting with Richard Malone of Wrightstown, he was receiving care from the overseers of the poor by at least 1765, which happens to be the first page of their poor book, so who knows how long he was on it before that, but by 1765 he was already a pauper and receiving aid. In April they plowed his garden and bought him a cord of wood. In May they bought him linen to make him shirts and tow to make him trousers. His wife was helping care for him, so she probably made the clothes. They actually a few times pay her to do his washing and mending. I haven't found a kind of explanation of this, but it seems to me, based on what I've seen in terms of parents and children and spouses sometimes receiving payment, once a person was considered a pauper, it seems to me that they kind of like lost the status that they would have had as like a member of the household, and then family members were sometimes paid directly for their upkeep, rather than it, you know, them being part of the poor relief system. So his wife received these materials and presumably made the clothes. In August, they bought him kersey, which is a heavy wool that you'd make like a pea coat out of, as well as shalloon, which would be a wool coat lining, mohair and buttons to make him a cloak, as well as thread and one pair of stockings. In November, they bought him a cord of wood, a pair of shoes, paid for his washing and the mending of his clothes, and gave him a weekly allowance of 3 shillings and 6 pence. And that was given on an annual basis. Or at least they build it on an annual basis. This is, of course, being an account book. It's stuff that they already paid for. So I don't know how they actually dole it out to him, but you see it recurring as annual charges. Then in April, they gave him 2 shirts and a pair of trousers, October, a pair of shoes, November, a bed blanket and a cord of firewood. December, they paid his rent and his weekly allowance, bought him a pair of stockings and more firewood, and paid his Sarah for washing him and his clothes. And these are the kinds of charges that you see repeating for him and for a lot of people like him. This is a pretty demonstrable case here. By the end of 1766, they had spent £20 on him, which at that time was a considerable sum of money. Later on, we see some evidence of the food that they provided, because they also provide food relief. So in 1771, he was given one bushel of wheat and 1 gallon of molasses. There's also in the same year, there's a list of an itemized list of food that wasn't only for him, but you know, there were other paupers under their care. But it gives you an idea of what all of them were given. The overseers of the poor spent money to purchase butter, rye, molasses, mutton, wheat, Indian corn, fowl, pork, middlings, veal, cheese, milk, beef, tea, sugar, pickled pork, gammon, and pepper. All of these were for distribution to paupers in Wrightstown Township. Then in 1772, Richard Malone died. They paid 20 shillings for his coffin, 6 for digging his grave, and 7 shillings, 6 pence for taking him to his grave. Then it's a little unclear. It seems like his wife Sarah was then not a pauper. She doesn't appear in the records after that point until 1785. So my guess is maybe, you know, usually the settlement of the wife followed the husband status, and so maybe he qualified for poor relief, but after he was after she had cared for him and he was dead, maybe she moved in with family members, whatever. She didn't, regardless of the specific reason, she herself did not receive poor relief. But after she died in 1785, the overseers of the poor took her remaining possessions and auctioned them off at a public vendue. And they did that to recoup some of the expense of caring for the person. Notably, they did not take it when they were alive. They didn't say, oh, well, you're a pauper, we're taking all your stuff. They kept it while they were alive, and then after they were dead, they would get what money they could for it. And you see that with a number of other instances in the Wrightstown Township account books, where they would care for the person when they were living, pay the rent, buy the food, etc., and then they would get what they could for their meager possessions. And sometimes they almost broke even, and more often it was not as much as they'd spent, as you might expect. They also provided medical and maternity care, and not so much in, well, Bucks County, you see a lot of maternity care, but it wasn't as pronounced as places like Philadelphia, where like a large percentage of people receiving relief were pregnant women, but you do see it in Bucks County. So for example, in 1772, the overseers of the poor brought B, first initial, no full name, B. Hampton, to be brought to Philadelphia for bladder stone surgery. They paid the prominent Philadelphia doctor, Thomas Bond, £11.10, quote, for cutting said Hellinger of, cutting quote Hellinger for the stone and medicines in the measles. So he had measles and he had bladder stones, and you know, that was an operation that they performed back then, but it was kind of a cutting edge medicine at that point to have bladder stone removal. And it was a fair amount of money to do so. In terms of maternity care, you see also, this is still in Wrightstown, in 1805 they paid $17.36 for keeping and nursing Sarah Terry in the time of her lying in, and clothing for her child. Lying in would be, after giving birth, a certain period of time, women were expected to just rest and not even get out of bed, basically. It's called the lying in period. The same year, 1805, they paid $20.30 for the care of Mary Yemens at the time of her lying in. 2 years later, she was living in Solbury, but had not gained a legal settlement, so Wrightstown had to pay Solbury for the burial of her child and her continued status as a pauper. So in her case, in Sarah Terry's case, she only needed help when she was, incapable of working, needed medical attention, as a mother to be and new mother. Mary Yemen's case, she also needed separate poor relief later on. And in terms of the funeral expenses, they were usually pretty simple. They would pay for a coffin. They would pay for the tending to the body. They would pay for a winding sheet, which would be kind of like a burial shroud, but instead of being like a garment, it would just be a sheet that the person would be wrapped in, paid to have them physically buried. That was usually it, but you sometimes find a little extra expenditure. So when Mary Wood died in 1790, in addition to the usual medical treatments before her death and her burial costs, the overseers of the poor of Wrightstown spent £1.08, quote, for tobacco and sundry other expenses extra at her burial. I believe that I saw one itemization of rum at a funeral too. That's kind of an examples of what you often saw. In some cases, they would also act as guardians for people that had some sort of financial resources, but couldn't administer them themselves. So in the Warminster Poor Book, you see the accounts listed for Rachel Noble, starting in 1790. So she was a widow, and it doesn't lay it all out because it's an account book, but what you can infer is that her husband had died, and then her estate passed to her daughter, which really meant it passed to her son-in-law, and then her son-in-law died, and she was owed a dower from the estate. So what usually happened then, if a husband died and his wife was still living and he also had living kids, instead of giving part of the estate or all of the estate to the wife, it would pass to his heir or heirs, and then the wife would receive life rights to some portion of the estate. That could be like, she gets the east wing of the house and her son has to bring her 10 barrels of apples, whatever it is. It's basically laying out conditions that would allow her to live comfortably for the rest of her life, but then when she died, she didn't will it to anybody else. It went then to her, to the husband's heirs. So in this case, it seems like it went to her son-in-law, who then died, and then her son-in-law's executor is then paying her dower. But in any case, she ended up being essentially a pauper, but was receiving money. So they have all of these expenses for her that they were then recouping the money for. Over the last years of her life, she was attended to, she received medical care, they paid her rent, they went so far as actually calling a jury to assess the value of her rent so they could be paying a fair price for it, and ultimately ended up, you know, paying someone for laying out her body, building a coffin, burying her, etc. And she must have still had friends and family in the community because William Yerkes was actually paid to travel to Philadelphia to invite people to her funeral. Overall, they spent £128 to maintain her, which was a lot of money, and they recouped all of it from her son-in-law's estate. So that would be a case in which someone had financial resources, but they couldn't take care of themselves for whatever reason. You know, presumably, if she had outlived both her husband and her son-in-law, she was probably elderly, in that case, the local government stepped in and provided the service to her, even though they got paid back for it. And that is, more or less how the actual aid was delivered. Back to the question of settlement. So, because of the fact that it was a public expense, and people were very wary of spending public money that they felt that they as township officials should not spend. There was a lot of back and forth about whether people had legal settlement in the township. So when you're talking about a township, that doesn't leave you much room for mobility. If you're a wage laborer, you might live all over the place over the course of a few years. And so to determine where you last had legal residence based on the criteria that they laid out could be a little challenging. To give you an idea of what qualified you, the laws that they enacted to determine who was legally settled, criteria that would give you legal settlement would be, for example, if you were born in the township, if you were brought in as an indentured servant and served a full year, if you paid above a certain amount in annual rent, if you paid taxes, if you served as a public official for at least 1 year, and if you were a married woman, as I said earlier, your status would follow that of your husband, which meant that on the one hand, you would gain your husband's status, but on the other hand, you'd lose your old status. So in Bucks County, I didn't see a whole lot of this necessarily, but in England, for example, there was a big issue with women that, they'd get married, their husband would die, they'd be a widow, then they'd be chargeable to the township, the parish where her husband's family had lived, even if that meant she was cut off from all of her actual family relations. And so she could have maybe been better off living with her parents, if they were still living, but instead she was stuck in the parish that she was currently living in, maybe with no friends or family, because the other township, or the parish in that case, wouldn't take her back, right? There are also other restrictions that would prevent people from getting poor relief, or would regulate the way poor relief was given out. So they actually formalized the requirement that grandparents, parents, and children are all mutually responsible for one another's care. So if your kid got sick, you had to take care of them. If you had elderly parents, you had to take care of them. Grandparents as well. I've seen some extreme cases where the people doing the caring were themselves pretty poor off and were still able to apply for relief. But if you were able to, you couldn't abandon your parents, grandparents, children, grandchildren. There's one case in New Hope Solbury area, a man named Peter Gift, his daughter, Rachel Shreves, was living with him, and she had two illegitimate twins, and he maintained them for a certain number of months, and then he petitioned to receive poor relief, even though they were his own grandchildren, because he just couldn't afford it. So you did see that, some exceptions to that. Also, under the original 1706 law in Pennsylvania, they didn't just give you the money out of the kindness of their hearts. They also publicly shamed you by making you wear a letter P on your right shoulder, and it would also have the first letter of the township or municipality you lived in. That isn't the only law that had that. And if you look at the really early court records, there are other offenses that criminals were forced to wear. I think maybe it was a T for thief, but they'd have to wear it on their arm, and that would apply to every member of the family that was a pauper, including children. The only exception listed in the law was for adults that are taking care of their own elderly parents. They didn't have to. I guess that was because that happened all the time. I believe that was removed at some point. I haven't seen it being revoked, but you don't see that. I've never seen any records of it actually happening. I have seen records of that actually happening for some other offenses in the 1600s in Bucks County. And later on, they also made some different rules about how to deal with children. You couldn't, in practice, they would often bind out poor children, as I mentioned earlier, but they actually formalized it in 1836. They They required overseers of the poor to bind out the children of paupers who couldn't be expected, who weren't expected to be able to maintain them at any time in the near future. And then in 1883, they updated that and made it illegal for children under the age of two, or sorry, over the age of two, to be in the almshouse unless they had some kind of disability or handicap. I feel like it's, my guess is that it's probably because it's a liability. You see a lot of these settlement disputes in the existing records. Presumably, you know, if you were a judge or a justice of the peace, you would hold on to this in case the person became chargeable to you again, because you would have a your copy saying, oh, no, it's Buckingham's fault, not me. And so a lot of the records that I have found for Solebury were actually disputes over settlement, that would be my guess. So, you know, if you find the poor book, that's great. You have the actual day-to-day of the overseers of the poor, but a lot of the papers are disputes, and you know, you kept them as legal documents in case they ever became chargeable to you again. And they also, with regard to the indenturing, they had to record indentured servants that entered the township. We'll edit that out of the recording. So in the Warminster Poor Book, actually, the first page of it is their register of indentured servants being brought in. So, for example, Daniel Longstreth brought Margaret Harley into the township in 1764, informing them, quote, to take notice that said Margaret Harley be entitled to benefit of the laws for the relief of the poor. So when you brought an indentured servant in, you were required to also register them so that it was official, you had them here, if they became chargeable to the township, it was all written down. And then there are also a bunch of disputes over liability. So, for example, from the Wrightstown Poor Book, Mary Lear, who was from Solebury, she had been living with James Lear in Wrightstown as husband and wife. Only problem was he was already married, he had already been legally married. They were living as husband and wife. He even got a mortgage out when they were living together, and she became pregnant with an illegitimate child, was living in Wrightstown at that time. Wrightstown argued that she could not claim settlement in the township because she was not legally married, even though by all conception of what a settlement would be other than the actual legal marriage, she was a resident of Wrightstown. And they also claimed that she had not independently signed the mortgage that he had signed, so she couldn't claim paying above a certain rent or housing expenses which would have independently qualified her as a resident. She didn't fill either of those criteria, they claimed, and so they said Solebury had to pay for her because she was, her last legal settlement was in Solebury, presumably where she was born or where her parents lived. Ultimately, they ended up, at first they refused. Ultimately, they ended up getting ruled against, and Solebury was like, no, you guys are liable, and Solebury did make them pay for it. Solebury had expended a bunch of resources, and they have all the expenses where they paid Solebury back for maintaining her and her child. Saluda was the name of the child. Interesting name. Couldn't find any reference of it anywhere else. And over the course of about 5 years, you see her on there. And finally, it was determined that, you know, whatever relationship she had had in Wrightstown, she was chargeable to Wrightstown. Another case, and this kind of goes to show the hardships faced by the working poor and how kind of wage laborers were really impacted by these settlement laws. William Dixon and his family lived in Solebury. When he was examined by justices of the peace to determine where his legal settlement was in 1798, he said that he was born in Wales. He came to New York as a British soldier in 1774, had left the army 18 years ago, and had come to Solebury and worked as a wage laborer for the Sebring family. So, over the course of 18 years, he had lived on and off in Solebury. He went back and forth, hired month to month by William White, which I believe indicated he was in Solebury, and that's where he married his wife, who would have then presumably previously had Solebury settlement. Then he moved up to Tinicum, worked for George Wall, ended up going all the way down to Prince George County, Maryland, leaving his family up in Bucks County, where he worked as a day laborer over 2 years, returned to Solebury, stayed the winter, moved back to Tinicum, you know, all this back and forth, where at different times he was filling a criteria. So, for example, he lived in Solebury at William Hamilton's for a year, paying $20 annual rent, then he went to Jersey, back and forth. Ultimately, they ended up determining that even though he had been an on and off resident for 18 years, he, quote, having lately come to inhabit the said township, didn't qualify. The idea being that his last legal settlement had been Tinicum, where he had been paying rent, even though he'd been living here before that and had been legally settled here, paying rent here before that. They forcibly removed him back to Tinicum because that was, you know, the last place he was economically successful, which is kind of the irony of it. If you're on hard times and you're a wage laborer and you're, as a result of, you know, financial necessity, moving from place to place to find work, they kick you back to the last place you were financially successful. So if you are sometimes able to pay rent and then are not, they kick you back to where you last paid rent, which is kind of ironic. You see another case where you kind of see how the poor relief system kind of doesn't necessarily, it keeps you at the, you know, the basic level needed to survive, but doesn't necessarily get you out of that. We have the case of Sarah Conaway, also from Solbury. In 1798, her husband abandoned the family, leaving her with her two young sons, one of them three, one of them only 4 months old. And she told the Justice of the Peace that her husband, that, quote, her husband has gone off and left her, she knows not whither, and that she has two living children, and further saith that she was left without provision or any means of support. So when examined by the Justice of the Peace to determine her residency, she said that her husband was born somewhere in New Jersey, doesn't know what township, and that he had actually been bound up by the overseers of the poor to someone in Hopewell Township until he was at the age of 21. 2 years after he finally finished his term of indenture, he married her. The next summer, he was in a poor state of health and again fell on poor relief, received about $5 from Hopewell Township, ultimately, the fact that he had received poor relief, which was actually another criteria for being considered a resident, if you had in the past received poor relief, that would also make you a resident. They determined that she and her two sons should be sent to Hopewell. So in that case, this guy, he was born into a poor family, got indentured out as a child, was an indentured servant, you know, having been indentured out as part of the poor relief system until 21. A couple years later, he was back on poor relief because he was sick, and a couple years later, he abandoned his family. His family was on poor relief. So it could be, sometimes it was a cycle like that. There are some counterexamples. There are also, you know, other children that were indentured out in Solbury Township that we have records of. Just to give you an idea of what the kind of the specifications of that contract were, I'll give you an example of another girl from Solbury. So she was probably about four and a half years old. You can infer that based on the fact that she was indentured till age 18, and it gives you the term of indenture of 13 years, 5 months, and 13 days. So she was probably only 4.5 years old. Her name is Sarah Brush, and she was indentured to William and Mary Coates of Solbury. So this is some of the text of the actual indenture to give you an idea of what the servant's obligations were and what the master's obligations were. Quote, the said apprentice, her master and mistress will faithfully the said apprentice, her said master and mistress, well and faithfully shall serve, their secrets keep, their lawful commands willingly obey. She shall do no damage to her said master and mistress's property or person, nor see it done without forthwith giving notice thereof to her said master and mistress. She shall not commit fornication nor contract matrimony within said term. She shall not frequent taverns, playhouses, or at cards, dice, or other unlawful games she shall not play. She shall not absent herself neither day nor night from her master's service, but in all things shall behave and demean herself as a faithful apprentice during the said term. And the said William Coates and Mary his wife, for their parts, shall the said Sarah Brush teach, instruct, or cause to be taught and instructed in the art and mystery of housekeeping, or in the best manner they are capable of. And the said master and mistress shall also during the said term find and allow unto the said apprentice sufficient meat, drink, washing, lodging, and apparel, and all other things needful or meant for such an apprentice. They also were required to give her 12 months of schooling, three of which had to be in the last 6 years of her apprenticeship. And at the end of the term, when she was 18, they had to give her two suits of clothes, suits of apparel, one of which was new, one could be used. And one other thing that they also, the overseer of the poor also did, which is kind of tangential to the rest of their obligations, was that they were also, in addition to indenturing out poor children that, you know, were members of families that just faced financial hardship, they were also the ones tasked with policing the states or the provinces or the colonies' anti-miscegenation law. They were the ones that were charged with binding out the mixed race children of a black and white parent, based on I believe it's a 1725 law. Any quote mulatto children would be slaves until the age of 31, and they couldn't, you know, even if one of their parents would have been able to financially sustain them, they weren't allowed to. They were taken by the government and bound out until as slaves, not indentured servants, but specifically as slaves until the age of 31. The overseers of the poor did that in addition to dealing with the poor children. There are some examples of that. If you look at the Bucks County Slave Register, after they abolished slavery It was a gradual, everyone that currently had a slave was still allowed to keep them, but they had to register them all. You see a number of people listed as mulatto slaves until 31 on that government record, and we have one relatively local case. In Upper Makefield, Mary Bottram was living there as they euphemistically call her an apprentice in the document, but she had been taken from the overseers of the poor by Quaker masters, and in 1776, the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting banned slave ownership among their members, and one of the, you know, as a result, they then followed up with all of the remaining slave owners and said, you have to get rid of your slave or you're out. And so they kept a manumission book that listed all of the records of slave being freed, and John and Mercy Chapman of Upper Makefield agreed to free Mary Bottram, who was had been indentured out to, or basically sent to them from by the overseers of the poor as a mixed race child, and they kind of commuted her sentence. They instead of freeing her at age 31, which was required by law, they agreed to free her at 18, which would have been the normal age for a female indentured servant. And they kind of have an excuse for it. They say, notwithstanding she was taken very young and our estate hath no way benefited by her, yet being principled against slavery of every kind of degree, they agree to do it. But it wasn't a very common occurrence, but the overseers of the poor did also bind out mixed race children as well. And again, the life outcomes of these indentured servants wasn't necessarily great. One historian, Sharon Salinger, who studied this in southeastern Pennsylvania, she studied servants that finished their indentures in the 1740s and then tracked them, comparing them to people that got married in the 1740s, the idea being that they would have become independent households around the same time, and she found that their life outcomes were much worse. In Philadelphia, within 10 years, about a quarter of the indentured servants she studied ended up calling upon public assistance within 10 years, compared to only 5 to 6% of the city's general inhabitants. Did I see you?
I did, but I didn't know what protocol was, whether to ask your question or wait till...
If it's like a confusion definition thing, I'd love to stop for a second. If it's like a follow-up question, I'd rather wait to the end, just for the sake of fun. Right. But I'm if I use some weird term and you're like, what does that mean?
No, it's just stop. File indentures.
Okay. So yeah, there were some counterexamples to that. There's one person that I've included in some of my other talks here before, so I'm not going to go too in depth with it. But in 1824, the Gibbs family ended up in the almshouse. Hannah Gibbs brought her 5 children, one of whom was Malin Gibbs, who was only 3 years old. And one of the directors of the poor, Moses Eastburn of Solbury, actually took him as an indentured servant, and he ended up a little better off. He ended up being able to buy his own farm and lived in Solbury and ended up being a conductor on the Underground Railroad. But he ended up having 15 children and working as a lime burner and a farmer, and wasn't ever wealthy, but did okay. So there are some counterexamples of people getting back into, you know, mainstream society after falling on the poor rolls for a while, but often the support that they received weren't quite enough to get them back to being, you know, a member of the general public. So that the system that I've just described was in place really from the Elizabethan era until 1810, when the almshouse opened, and you know the actual government positions and stuff remained in place. So you still had overseers of the poor, and you still had people, you know, doing the whole settlement thing and all that, but it was really more for people that were needed temporary assistance. They were the, quote, outdoor poor, being people that were outside the doors of the almshouse. You continue to have, you know, this government system in place, dealing with people that needed short-term assistance, people that were too sick to be moved, either, you know, from one township to another or from one township to the almshouse. The kind of general framework still kind of continued. But what ended up happening in 1810 was that they opened the county almshouse and they ended up centralizing the poor relief system so that instead of every township dealing with it individually and using the overseers of the poor, I should say, also were tasked with levying a tax. It was a property-based tax that on the township level you'd raise the tax to pay for your own paupers. And so the idea would be to centralize it. It would save money. Instead of everyone dealing with it on the local level, you could do it on the county level. So they ended up, deciding to create an almshouse. That was not an innovation. Workhouses were something also that dated back to England before the period of colonization. The idea, one of the main ideas, being that instead of just providing relief, you also provide work for them to do. If it was a workshop or a poor farm, the goods raised would either support the poor or maybe be sold to support the poor. So the almshouse ended up being built in what's now Doylestown Township. It was the first public institution to be brought to the Doylestown area before it became the county seat, which the courthouse opened there in 1813. That's kind of when the county seat, it became the official county seat, but the almshouse was there first. It was located at the intersection of Almshouse Road and what's now 611. I'm sure a lot of you probably pass by it pretty regularly. It's not there, but some of the facilities from it are there, and the county has since used it for all kinds of other purposes. The old Almshouse Farm now has the jails and a bunch of other stuff on it, which we'll talk about. So the almshouse, one of the main things was to kind of provide, you know, a working farm that would help save costs. And instead of, you know, dealing with it locally, they do it centralized. They also, you know, were able to have an almshouse doctor who was on call for dealing with medical issues. They still ended up paying for, you know, doctors locally for people that needed outdoor relief. The idea would be that it would save expense. The downside of that was that in practice, it ended up with like much worse living conditions for the paupers. Instead of being cared for in someone's house, whether it's a relative or some community member, and having your rent paid, you're in an institution that had pretty deplorable living conditions, pretty low compared to the food that they were giving people in that Wrightstown poor book. You're basically given mush and milk to eat for breakfast every morning, and you know, very minimal food, and you know, you're more likely to be wearing rags than a kersey and mohair jacket that your wife sewed for you. The actual almshouse itself, we use the painting here as a visual. This painting is called View of the Almshouse. It's actually the painter itself is unknown. It was an anonymous gift to the Michigan Museum. They date it as circa 1900 based on the bicycle. And actually, these photographs over here are also circa 1900. They were taken by Linford Craven, who didn't establish his studio until 1885, and then they were published in W.W.H. Davis's second edition of the History of Bucks County, which was published in 1905, so it's in that tight date range. And if you actually take a look, you'd see the trees are the same size and the fences are in the same location. So it all, you know, it seems pretty consistent that it'd be circa 1900. The original almshouse building here, you see there's a low entrance, and feel free to come up and look at this afterwards, but there's a low entrance that would bring you to the communal dining area. The upper floors were large, what they called wards, which were large kind of communal living quarters. Over here we have the Rodman House, which is the farmhouse that was on the property before the county bought it for the almshouse. That was used in the early years as kind of a small hospital, as well as having rooms for other people. Somewhere on the property there were what they called the cells, which were these horrible little basically dungeons that they kept the insane in, where they were chained to the floor, and we'll talk about that. But I'm looking at this and I'm not sure if it was torn down or not. We have a few outbuildings, but they could be outhouses, they could be chicken coops, who knows? But I'm not sure if the cells are pictured here. And then you have the hospital, which was built to kind of improve the care for people that were at the almshouse for, you know, medical reasons or physical frailty or whatever. That was built in 1868. So the almshouse, it was kind of a catch-all for people that had, you know, for any reason fell on hard times, just like the general poor relief system was. But in this case, they were all being housed together. So you had, people that were facing financial hardship, who were, you know, straight up just the poor. You also had a lot of elderly and sick. To some extent, it was kind of even used as almost like a hospice. You see a lot of people that come into the almshouse and in a few months they're dead. And presumably they stayed out as long as they could. And then when they're, you know, whoever... their landlord or their family member, whoever they were living with, just couldn't take care of them anymore. They sent them to the almshouse and died shortly thereafter. And you see that a lot. And also a lot of elderly people that may have taken care of themselves their whole lives, but face financial hardship in their old age. There were also a lot of pregnant women that would come in just to give birth and leave again. There are a number of records that you find in the almshouse register of that. Sometimes they'd stay for a while. Sometimes the children would be bound out. Sometimes they'd come in, give birth, and leave. Intellectually disabled and insane. As you can imagine, the mental health treatment in this time period was pretty brutal. A lot of really awful stuff went on. But, you know, it... just like anyone else who couldn't support themselves, people that had an intellectual disability or were, you know, mentally ill, would be sent there. And a lot of times, all of these different groups of people would be commingled in the housing. We had these large rooms that, you know, you might have. They were segregated by gender and by race. But short of that, you could have a room that was some elderly women, some poor women, some pregnant women. sometimes they'd give birth in the room with all the other people. We do get a little bit more information about the poor as a social group from this period, because they were centralized in one place, and you can actually find them on the U.S. Census. And give you an idea of who required poor relief kind of demographically, which you couldn't really do looking at just the poor relief papers that you find elsewhere. So for example, if you look at the breakdown from 1810 until 1940, which are all of the census records that you have for the almshouse, you can see that it's heavily weighted male. So it averages 63% men at the almshouse over the course of 110 years, and with a high of 75% men in 1940. But, you know, mostly it's in the 60s. If you look year by year, it's mostly in the 60s, but it's, you know, still predominantly men. Disproportionately immigrant. So starting in 1850, when you have good records for this, on average, 22% of the inmates at the almshouse were born in another country, and almost all of them were men. It was about 70%, on average, 70% of the immigrants were men, and 22% of the residents of the almshouse were immigrants. So you can imagine a lot of these people, you know, came to the U.S. looking for work. A lot of them were elderly, so they had actually probably worked as wage laborers or done the best they could for decades, and then ultimately, without family connections and social connections, being immigrants, they ended up here. Either way, for some reason, you know, there was a disproportionate rate of immigrants at the almshouse. You can kind of guess what that may be. Those are some of my guesses. A lot were also, as you might imagine, sick or disabled. The records for this aren't great, but the best record is from 1880, when they actually, the U.S. Census included a separate schedule that was, I'm gonna mess up the actual name, but it's something like the Defective, Dependent, and Delinquent Classes Schedule, which tracked all, you know, basically all the different kinds of people that would end up in the almshouse. Homeless children, people that were intellectually disabled or insane, and people that had physical disabilities were all on that. And so you get a pretty good breakdown. In 1880, 32% of the people at the almshouse and the hospital were suffering from those kinds of problems. When they finally started opening state asylums for the insane, it greatly reduced the almshouse population and kind of cut down a lot of the problems of housing the severely mentally ill with people that were just poor or sick or what have you. And so, for example, in 1900, the almshouse had a total of 113 patients, whereas the Norristown State Asylum had 110 patients from Bucks County. So almost as many, basically as many people were in the almshouse from Bucks County were also in the Norristown State Asylum as people that had mental issues. A lot of these people also, you know, in addition to the stuff we've just been talking about health issues or disabilities or what have you, there are also people that were just working poor. You see again and again this record of people living out and, you know, out of the almshouse and working and getting by on their own in the summer months when they can find, like, you know, work as farm laborers, etc. And then they have to, you know, fall back to the almshouse when they can't support themselves because they can't, you know, get their wage labor jobs in the winter. So just to give you a few newspaper accounts from this era. So from 1858, they said, quote, this is all from the Intelligencer, "The Bucks County Almshouse has a large family of paupers at present. The scarcity of work and general suspension of business at the commencement of the cold weather having doubtless driven many unfortunate creatures to the almshouse for relief." Then in 1869, "The old house now contains 170 inmates, which is below the average number. Those who are able to shift for themselves in warm weather are now rambling about the country or visiting their friends, but their return may be looked for when the cold nights set in." And then finally, in 1900, again, they wrote, "The regular spring exodus of inmates who had been harbored at the institution during winter months had started with a jump during the past month, 35 having severed their connections with the home." So, you know, that's between 1858 and 1900, same story. So all of that, you know, basically the entire time the Alms House was there, you had these people that, you know, were just struggling to get by. They were, you know, they probably worked every day during the summer months, but they just couldn't find a job in cold weather because of the fact that it was an primarily agricultural economy. And, you know, what are they going to do? So you had these people that were just constantly returning to the Alms House. Some people, you know, maybe one winter they fall in hard times and end up there, and other winters they don't. But a lot of people consistently ended up back at the Alms House. And when if they couldn't be there, they wouldn't be there because it was not a pleasant place to be. You also see in a later report that I'll be going through, they talk about the difference in the number of people per room in the two different seasons. It dramatically jumps up, and people are sleeping on the floor, etc. So in terms of the actual, you know, the fact that it was a poor farm and house of employment, that was one of the terms for it. They were, you know, everyone there was working. They weren't just going there and staying in their room and getting fed. They were almost all doing some sort of labor to the best of their ability. For example, we have an account from a man named Enoch Allen, who was one of the first paupers to enter the almshouse when it opened in 1810. He was interviewed during a visitation of the almshouse in 1819, and he told his examiners that he was a tailor. That was his profession, you know, before he entered the almshouse, and that he'd worked at his trade every day since he arrived, except for 3 days when he was sick. He was then 72 years old, and he had suffered from rheumatism for 15 years. So presumably, he was still working as a tailor. He just couldn't do it well enough, you know, because of his physical issues to make a living at it, to, you know, pay rent or whatever, to really get by, but he was able to still practice that trade at the almshouse, and it was the case with a lot of people. To give you an idea of some of the work that they did there, I'll give some examples from a financial report that was published in the newspaper in 1852 to show you some of the stuff they farmed, some of the stuff they made. So in 1852, they produced pork, hay, wheat, rye, oats, buckwheat, corn, potatoes, sauerkraut, cabbage, wool, beans, beeves, calves, lambs. They made one revolving hay rake, one cultivator, 5 meat tubs, 1 set of running gears for a wagon, 200 panels of fence posts. And then they manufactured shirts, underdresses, pairs of pantaloons, pairs of shoes, roundabout coats, vests, pairs of stockings, aprons, hunting shirts, sheets, pillowcases, shirts, children's aprons, children's shirts, children's drawers, bed cases, sunbonnets, pairs of mittens, bolster cases, nightcaps, bolsters, bed ticks, pairs of suspenders, hand towels, nightgowns, quilts, women's laces, brooms, candles, barrels of soap, tow linen, flax sheeting, cotton stripe, carpet, linsey, lard kegs, buckets, piggins, wash tubs, and of course, coffins and winding sheets. Which I would note, they had previously bought from outside of the house and then started manufacturing them themselves. So they were hardworking. They were getting a lot done, and you know, they were as the painting here would indicate. There was a lot of both agricultural production going on, as you can see here, but also within the almshouse there were various workshops for, you know, weaving or doing the various production of all the items that I just mentioned. And then another indication of the kind of work that people did and the kind of lives they lived before entering the almshouse is the list of professions that you see on the U.S. Census. So, for example, taking the list from 1880, you see that you know, all of the people living there had all had some profession, and some of them still practice this profession in the almshouse. People that were almshouse inmates had worked or currently worked as laborers, butchers, brickmakers, shoemakers, farm laborers, weavers, carpenters, dyers, blacksmiths, doing housework, nurses, seamstresses, tailors, cigar makers, millers, even telegraph operators. There's a wheelwright, a merchant, a cooper, a clerk, a cabinet maker, a sailor, a boatman, a gardener, a harness maker, a peddler, a sailmaker, a stonemason, servants, washerwomen, housekeepers. Of all of the inmates at the almshouse and hospital, and I should have said earlier, the term they were properly termed inmates, both at both institutions, even if it was the hospital. Only 3 of the people on the list in 1880 did not have a profession listed, even if it was just laborer. 2 of them were intellectually disabled. 1 of them actually was listed as both idiotic, which was a term for someone that was severely intellectually disabled, insane, and paralyzed. So she didn't have a job. Eliza Limehouse did not have a job. But and then the other 2, one of them was listed as idiotic, and the other person was listed as insane. So everyone else that worked there in 1880 had some kind of, either had a profession before they ended up in the almshouse, or was still practicing some sort of craft or something, or farming there. Even people that were listed as insane, etc. So the living conditions, as I alluded to a few times, were not ideal. So they were housed in the alms, the original almshouse before the hospital was built. They were housed communally. The paupers were slept two to a bed in large rooms where people were kind of crowded together. The population swelled in the winter months, and many people had to sleep on the floor, especially in winter. And you know, in some cases, in the old almshouse before the hospital was built, some inmates were grouped together based on health conditions, or you know, old age, or people that needed to be confined. You might have two insane people in a room, etc. But largely, they were just kind of commingled. I mean, there's one instance. I forget if I included it in here, but. There was an insane woman that lived in the hallway, it's pretty ridiculous conditions. That was before they built a separate hospital to help alleviate this concern. It was severely overcrowded. There are examples of women being forced to give birth in these shared rooms. The children were housed with the women instead of living separately. Before I go into the really dark stuff, I'll give you one little silver lining here, which is a newspaper report about a visitation to the almshouse from 1861 that said, "The baby department seemed to be in flourishing condition. About a dozen little responsibilities of various ages were there, some of them quite bright-looking children. A few of the older ones were playing horse through the rooms or chasing each other in childsome glee up and down the spacious halls. Children will be children, and playfulness their prevailing trait, whether found in a place or an almshouse." Maybe some of the children didn't realize what the conditions were, but then we proceed to an 1868 report that gives you a better idea of what the conditions were. So I'm going to just read some excerpts from it. This report was issued in response to people that tried to prevent the almshouse hospital from being built. It was already under construction, but there were people in the county that thought it was a waste of money, didn't want to use county funds to build this hospital, and tried to get an injunction against the construction. And so this group, I believe it was a grand jury, was convened to go visit the almshouse and determine whether or not a hospital was necessary, and a hospital was necessary. So they went room by room through the entire place and gave a detailed account. I'll just give you a few examples of that to kind of show you what the living conditions were. So on the first floor of the almshouse, in one of the rooms, it was a bedroom occupied by colored women, 13 by 17 feet, containing four beds and a stove at the present time, and now occupied by 9 persons. During the winter, it was occupied by 14 persons. No additional beds could be placed in the room, and the 5 additional persons were compelled to sleep upon the floor. There was a men's sitting room, 31 by 15 feet, which is occupied during the day as a sitting room, and during the night at present, 10 male paupers have it allotted to them as a sleeping place, the floor being their bed. And in winter, it is at times used as a sleeping room by a number varying from 20 to 40, varying in the proportion to the number of inmates from time to time. So the spillover was just floor. On the second floor, there was a bedroom for females, 23 by 17 feet, now containing 8 beds and a stove, at present time occupied by 12 persons, all of whom are either crazy, sick, or imbecile. During the winter months, there were 16 women quartered in this room without increasing the number of beds, and during the winter, one woman was confined therein. The term confined, I'm not sure if it means physically confined, as some of the crazy people were, or it could be she was there for her lying in, I'm not quite sure. Then, also on the second floor, there's a female bedroom, 12 by 17 feet, now containing 3 beds and a stove, occupied by 5 persons. During the winter, it contained 4 beds and 8 persons, during which latter time, there were 2 women delivered of children in the room thus occupied. Pretty crowded to be giving birth in that room. In the Rodman House, which was, the original colonial-era farmhouse that was already standing there, which was used as a sort of hospital before the real hospital was built. One of the rooms on the first floor there was a bedroom used as a sick ward, 15 by 17 feet, which now contains and has contained for a long time 7 beds and 7 persons, all of whom are women, the oldest of whom is 93 years of age and the youngest 80. All of them may be described as bedfast and helpless. So that was kind of the general population. Then we get to the cells, which were brutal conditions. The cells were separate. I'll include the description. But there's a separate building that the people that the insane that they considered to be dangerous, etc., were housed. These are a nondescript erection, impossible to describe, being a species of oubliette, which is a type of dungeon. An oubliette specifically has an entrance on the top that you throw people down a hole, basically. I'm not sure if they meant that in the technical sense, but that's what an oubliette is. So it's a species of oubliette. one story high with a cellar underneath and with a passageway running along them in which a stove is placed for the purpose of heating the cells. They were formerly heated by a stove placed in the cellar, which means of warmth was so wholly inadequate that the wretched inmates were frozen, meaning frozen to death sometimes, died of exposure. The present mode of heating is now wholly inadequate, but it is better than that which formerly existed, though they must still suffer intensely from the cold. There's no means of ventilation. Each cell is but 7 by 4 feet in dimensions. Cleanliness is impossible, and the miserable beings who are confined do not possess even the advantages of wild beasts in a traveling menagerie. The odor which arises from the cells is at once repulsive and disgusting, and your petitioners believe that if this miserable relic of a bygone barbarism was seen by and known to the citizens of Bucks County in its horrible repulsiveness of detail, a feeling of horror would thrill the community. 4 of these cells are now occupied by human beings bereft of reason, and whose only crime is that the hands of the Almighty has been laid heavily upon them. So that, by the way, was when there were 175 inmates at the almshouse. The average in winter was 250 for the 5 years preceding that, according to the report. Not exactly a place I'd want to live. And as a result, a lot of people ran off. You see in the records, you see a lot of people that were listed as runaway, a lot of people that were listed as eloped. And some of them were people that had, say mental issues or dementia or something. And a lot of them just did not want to be there. Later on, they did build the hospital, which alleviated a lot of that. But then, a few years later, the original almshouse itself was falling apart. We have a few reports from 1898 that the old building, which in its dilapidated condition, will admit many a bitter blast this winter upon the aged and infirm patients. A good tight barn would make a better winter residence. Mm. And then the earlier the same year, they said that the old building's condition is getting worse. We are told that time of driving rain, it becomes necessary to move the tables in the dining room to one side in order to keep them out of the wet, which beats into the rooms through the window frames. We feel that a building in such a case is simply a disgrace to Bucks County. But by that point, the people actually living in the almshouse proper were mostly able-bodied paupers, whereas the hospital housed most of the people that had major physical issues or mental issues, but still there are a lot of people living in those pretty deplorable conditions. So as the cells might indicate, the people are really worst off for the mentally ill, which early on especially were treated very poorly. So in addition to the cells, which I mentioned, where people were physically just chained to the floor and couldn't even move, there were a number of instances that ranged from neglect to people being punished. In 1819, there was a visitation to the almshouse to investigate a bunch of allegations about misconduct, some of which seemed to be pretty true based on the actual testimony. There's a pamphlet that lists every single person's testimony. They ended up ruling in favor of the almshouse. I think they're probably wrong based on the testimony there. But one of the causes for concern was a young man named Bill Murray, who is intellectually disabled. There was this concern about him wandering off a lot. He was known to frequently escape from the almshouse, and to prevent him from doing so, they made him wear a heavy chain and weight on his ankle to prevent him from running away. And despite the hopple that they put on him, they still found him all over the place. Various witnesses attest to the fact that they'd seen him in Doylestown and Hoville, which is now what we would call Edison, wearing his chain. And there was a good deal of concern about him escaping in the winter, especially without shoes. And an employee of the almshouse confirmed that on one cold night when it was discovered that he'd run away, they actually rounded up all the able-bodied paupers and tried to hunt them down because they were worried he was going to freeze to death. He is not the only person that happened to. In 1888, we have a newspaper account that gives another couple examples. A colored man without clothing except a shirt and one stocking was found on the farm of Nathaniel Duckworth in Warrington on September 15th. He'd gotten away from the almshouse on the Monday preceding and had been wandering about for 5 days without food. He was ravenously hungry when found. He was taken in at Mr. Duckworth's and made comfortable. Word was sent to Steward Vandegrift, who was running the almshouse, and the man, he gave his name as William Dorsey, was taken back to the almshouse. He was evidently somewhat deranged, and he looked to be over 80 years of age, so you can assume maybe he had some sort of dementia, just wandered off, and they let him, because they didn't have very good standards in place. And then the article continues, about 20 years ago, an old lady was found dead upon the same property. She had also wandered from the almshouse and had been dead about 3 days when found. There was snow on the ground and she died of exposure. So that sort of thing happened pretty regularly. In Solbury, there's actually a man, they found the skeletal remains of a man in Huffnagel's Woods, which is down past where the Wawa is now, who after some investigation they determined was John Cunningham, an almshouse inmate, who had been in the almshouse for 13 years and then wandered off and ended up in Solbury, and he was buried in Solbury Friends Meeting. On the burial record, they list him as man found in woods, because they didn't know until a couple weeks later, I believe, who he was. So that happened pretty regularly, and both people escaping because they didn't want to be there, and people that maybe may not have had their mental faculties about them wandering off. They also, didn't provide adequate, mental health care in really any regard. Later on, they ended up, as reform movement started in the later part of the 1800s, there were, these social welfare reformers that pushed for, the creation of dedicated mental asylums and the reform of the conditions, the use of treatment instead of just confining. There certainly improvements were made. Looking back, it is pretty bizarre that you had the steward and the matron of the almshouse were responsible for farming and for mental health treatment. Expecting one person to be doing both without any experience, because they were appointed by the county commissioners, I believe. They did not necessarily have any experience doing what they were doing, and there's a fair amount of corruption, more or less, whether formal corruption or just kind of not so people not being perfectly on the level that occurred at the almshouse. You can see why it was not necessarily the best way to lump together the poor farm and the treatment of the insane. But eventually they didn't prove it. The creation of the hospital allowed them to house people separately. They had, they were able to put people in heated rooms instead of a stone cell outside. But in the earlier days, it was just to give you an idea of how rough it was. The testimony of Sarah Dubery, who was one of the people who testified in the 1819 investigation about the conditions in the almshouse, she had testified that she would sometimes, another worker brought the food to the people chained in the cells, but she would sometimes visit them, and she told her examiners, quote, "I sometimes combed their hair or took them a piece of pie." She said that they were never allowed out of their cells, quote, "When I first saw them, they were in their cells. They were never out till they were carried out," meaning dead. And two of them she had found dead. One of them, she testified that she had told the matron that she had visited him and thought he wasn't going to survive the day, and that the matron had refused to attend to him in his final hours. And in another line of questioning, when asked in general how the matron, who was expected to care for people as they were dying, how she treated them, not specifically about the cells, but about them in general, about the paupers in general, Sarah replied, "I went sometimes and told her I thought some of them were dying. She said it was a matter of no consequence. They were poor, miserable vagabonds whose bad conduct had brought them here. They must not expect to be attended to as if they were gentlemen and ladies, to go to my work and never mind them." People contested her testimony, but some of the details really work out, so I tend to believe her. So as it was reformed, though, they got rid of some of the most horrific aspects of this. In 1871, the superintendent of the hospital reported that none of the 18 insane inmates were chained, and bragged that, quote, "the chains are getting rusty." In a visitation in 1873 by the president of the State Board of Public Charities, again, part of this reform movement that's trying to improve these conditions, he said, of the insane people are quartered on the second floor, where they have sufficient accommodation. Most of them are gentle and easily managed, but there are a few who at times have acute mania and are then difficult to manage. There are two or three of whose hands are confined to prevent them from tearing off and destroying their clothes. One or two of the more violent were fastened with chains to the floor. The rooms or cells were in a condition of perfect cleanliness, and all the inmates, except those who were closely confined, seemed to be in good physical health. There is no provision whatever in the institution for the intelligent and suitable treatment of curable cases of insanity, and those who are sent there are consequently liable to become permanently deranged. The law requires that curable cases shall be sent to the state asylum in Harrisburg, which is especially provided for patients who are not able to pay the expense of private treatment. There are one or two cases in the county hospital that ought to be disposed of in that way at once. And they also went on to recommend that they make an exercise yard just for the insane, so they can be brought out of their confined spaces without risk of hurting anybody else. We get another look at the treatment of the mentally ill in 1880 when they had that the defective, dependent, and delinquent schedule, as mentioned earlier, which provides some more specific details about people's health issues. In 1880, on the census, they provide full information for three of the inmates that were listed as insane. There are a couple more that they only list the name and don't provide all the details, so I'm just going to talk about the 33. 12 of them were only locked up at night. 18 had to be confined at all times. Of those 18 who were always locked up, 8 were restrained with muffs, and 1 was restrained with a straitjacket. So in the age before, you could have psychoactive drugs that might help alleviate some of the issues with physically restraining people. You know, I guess kind of who are we to judge, but definitely there was room for improvement, and it improved over the years, but it was definitely not ideal. And again, with the creation of the state hospital in Harrisburg, and then there were also state hospitals in Norristown and Byberry, which are the closest ones to Bucks County. Bucks County didn't have its own. They were able to send patients that needed treatment to these specific locations. And actually in 1880, on that schedule I mentioned in the census, it does indicate that I believe it was 9 of them had at one point been sent for some period of time to these state-run asylums. So they had, you know, maybe one might think when it was some kind of acute issue, maybe were sent there and then maybe got brought back to the Bucks County Hospital when they, you know, maybe were more manageable or had received some treatment. Or maybe they decided they weren't a curable case and sent them back. I don't know. But there is evidence that even the people still at the almshouse had been receiving more specialized treatment at state hospitals. Another issue that arose with the almshouse there's some questionable issues with is the treatment of the dead. Most of the people who died at the almshouse were buried in the almshouse potter's field. The location of the burial ground isn't currently marked, and I've done my best to find it, and I even emailed one of the zoning officers hoping there would be some kind of restriction on building there, but I wasn't able to figure it out. But based on the written records from the time, it seems to indicate it's probably around where Turk Park is now located. If anyone's familiar with the area, it's the northwest corner of the old almshouse farm. Right across the street. It would be, if this is the Rodman House, would be in the backfield there. That's my best guess. There's one reference to, there was a cholera outbreak in 1849 that about 80 some people died in. Like the majority of the people living in the almshouse died in, you know, in the course of 2 weeks, I think it was. The steward and his son also died. It was pretty rough. And in that case, they dug a mass grave that is specifically stated to be on that side of the road. But the general burial ground, there's a reference when they laid it out in 1810. They said in the field adjacent to the old orchard. And then in another record, in a newspaper account talking about how well the place was kept up, they mentioned the fence around the burial ground in the far field. So to me, that seems the most likely. And the fact that there isn't any buildings on it makes me think that maybe there'd be a burial ground there rather than where the prisons are located, but I haven't been able to exactly figure it out. Regardless, it was the county run Potter's Field, so people that died at the almshouse and other people that died elsewhere were also brought there. As a side note, there was actually a county run Potter's Field, a Potter's Field, I should say, is a public burial ground where you bury paupers or people that were executed for crimes, etc. There was actually one in Doylestown that's now a house, which is kind of interesting. It's across from Doylestown Cemetery, and they actually disinterred the people buried there in 1855 and moved them to the almshouse Potter's Field and then sold it, and now there's a house on top of it. It's on the corner of East Street and Court Street, I believe, and I've driven by and been like, I wonder if they know. In addition to being the burial ground for the residents of the almshouse and the hospital, it was also a public potter's field. And the paupers were afforded a very simple burial, like the records from the pre-almshouse era. They were, you know, given a coffin and a winding sheet. And they were not provided with headstones. It was a very simple burial. Burial in the potter's field was considered a rather ignominious end, and something that friends and relatives of the deceased should be ashamed of, according, if you believe the contemporary newspaper accounts anyway. So for example, in the Daily Intelligencer, they published an article in 1887 about a young woman who had committed suicide and ended up being buried there. They said, there is another fresh mound in Potter's Field at the Bucks County Almshouse. It is the final resting place of Annie Miller, who committed suicide at Lyon Lexington early Thursday morning. The poor girl had no one to love her, no one who cared to see she was buried decently in this Christian land. She was refused a place of burial in a churchyard, and last of all, her own mother refused to receive her remains or personal effects. The circumstances of the suicide were indeed sorrowful, but the ending was such that it should pain the hearts of the community. Odd that the burial should be worse than the suicide, but it does give you an idea that it was not considered, it was considered a pretty disgraceful place for someone to be buried. There's another article complaining about people not paying for the medical treatment of insane people that they were obligated by family relationship to, and the headline was like, stop sending people to the Potter's Field, you know, no more pauper burials. Again, the burial being considered in some, at least maybe exact in some, with some exaggeration, worse than the treatment during their life. There was also in the same year they ran an article about Civil War veterans that were living at the almshouse or died at the almshouse who had lost their enlistment papers or other documentation to prove that they had served in the war, in the Civil War, and could therefore be sent to the soldiers' home in Erie. And the author complained that, quote, there are 13 soldiers' graves in the almshouse burial ground, only two of which are marked. Again, like, these people shouldn't be buried there. Not to say much about the paupers that were also buried there, but it was not considered great. One burial there that I'm personally touched by is that of Peg Tuckamoney, who lived on my family's farm. They called her she's remembered as the last Lenape woman in the area. You know, there's a common myth in America about someone in some community being the last Indian, but she was a Lenape, and she we don't have records for any of her family members after her death. But she and her husband received poor relief in 1823 when they lived in Plumstead, I believe, and they received outdoor poor relief. And then her husband died around 1830, and she, you know, was able to live on her own for another 13 years. She rented the cottage on our family's farm that had been the original log cabin the Quakers had built before they built the stone house for at least a couple years, and was able to subsist on her own. She was a basket weaver. She got by until she hit age 77 and had no family around or enough of a community relation to kind of maintain her in her last few months. And she went to the almshouse in 1843, died later that year at the age of 78, and just for the last few months needed to be in the almshouse, and she was buried in the Potter's Field. So another Solbury local there. There's also an issue in that 1819 visitation. There was an allegation by Sarah Dewberry, who I mentioned was an almshouse employee, that the matron was stealing the nice burial clothes of some of the inmates and burying them in rags instead. She said that her mistress said that it was nonsense to put such things in the ground, and instead put rags in them. And two of the people that it was alleged that happened to were actually from Solbury. So one of them was Deborah Hill, who had been receiving outdoor poor relief before the almshouse was built in 1808. She was unmarried, when she was unmarried and pregnant, and already had a three-year-old. At that point, you know, the local authorities knew that if she gave birth in the township of Solbury, she would be they would be obligated to pay for the child. But instead of shipping her off back to Buckingham, they made an agreement with Buckingham where Buckingham would agree to pay for the child, even though legally its settlement would be in Solbury if they didn't move her. She shows up in the record there, is receiving outdoor poor relief, and then she's one of the first inmates that goes to the almshouse when it opens in 1810. She is sent there with her three children, ended up dying shortly thereafter. Her infant daughter also died there before she did. Her one son, Gov Hill, was indentured out to Jacob McGill in Solbury, and the third child there's no record of. But she ended up being buried there. I believe Sarah Dewberry's testimony, because in the almshouse register, it itemizes the clothing she brought, and she brought way more than most other paupers. She brought a full set of clothes with her, including one long gown, two linsey petticoats, three short gowns, two shifts, one cloak and bonnet, three pairs of hose, one pair of shoes, and she was given one pair of shoes by the almshouse, but all of the other stuff she brought with her. And compared to the other people that came in at the same time, that was a fair amount of clothing. So the fact that she was one of the people that was alleged that her clothing was stolen totally lines up. And another person that the matron was accused of stealing clothes of was another Solbury resident named Catherine Pavender, who entered the almshouse at the age of 60 in 1810. When she was there, she actually got married. she married a man named Thomas Neff, one of the friends of the, I think it was actually, might have been the treasurer of the almshouse too, is the one that officiated the ceremony. She had brought in a bonnet, three caps, three handkerchiefs, three petticoats, two shifts, two pairs of pockets, which I had to look up. Pockets were apparently a separate article of clothing. I had no idea. Two long gowns, three short gowns, three check aprons, two pairs of stockings, two pairs of pillowcases, one pair of shoes. Again, compared to everyone else that I've seen in that 1810 listing, this is a lot of personal possessions. So it makes sense that if the matron was going to steal something, this is what she would steal. And it was alleged that they called her Katie Neff in the testimony rather than Catherine Cavender or Catherine Neff, but clearly the same person, and you know, another resident of Solbury whose possessions were allegedly, her good burial clothes were allegedly stolen and she was buried in rags. Then in later years it got a little different. And you know, you could make two arguments about this. One is that it's totally necessary and benefit to society. Another one is that the people that it happened to should have had more of a say in it. But starting in 1883, Pennsylvania passed a law that said that any government agency in the state that was tasked with burying bodies at the public expense, instead of burying them, had to send them to medical schools as medical cadavers. So there was certainly a need for that. There was a lot of instances of grave robbing, which was happening instead. You know, surgical schools and, you know, medical schools had this problem of sourcing enough bodies for their students, which, you know, very, very good point on that. I have a little bit of a concern about the fact that they then targeted the most vulnerable members of society to send the bodies of. they first passed a law that only applied in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, presumably where there were actually medical colleges in 1867. And in that law, it should be noted that, quote, if the deceased person during his or her last sickness of his or her own accord shall request to be buried, that the body would be buried instead of being turned over. When they passed the statewide law in 1883, they got rid of that little clause. And if you look at the actual burial record, death records and burial records from that time period, that does bear that out. So you see a lot of people from the almshouse that were sent to the anatomical board. There are other people that were, you know, retrieved by friends and family. Occasionally a religious or veterans charitable group would claim the body and bury the person. And a couple people have, it lists it in the almshouse ledger book as BCH, which I'm assuming is Bucks County Home, but a lot of the other ones say SAB, which would be, I'm assuming, sent to anatomical board. And then cross-referencing that with death certificates, you can see a lot of them actually say anatomical board, which indicates that. So a lot of people, instead of being buried after 1883 at the almshouse, were actually sent to be used as medical cadavers, presumably whether they wished to or not. And I did find one case that applied to a local person. So Emery Schenck, who died in 1907 at the Bucks County Hospital at the age of 63, was actually from New Hope. He was born in Hunterdon County and was last living in New Hope before he was sent to the Bucks County Hospital in 1880. Records indicate that he was suffering from rheumatism and, quote, general debility from intemperance. Information. there was a whole separate column on the census for whether or not they were intemperate, and that was also in addition to that being checked. There was a separate note. Information about his life is not really readily available, but I did find a record showing that he had enlisted in the Navy in 1864, and he does appear on the New Hope Veteran Schedule for the 1890 census. When he died, on his death certificate, his birthplace is incorrectly listed as Pennsylvania. Oddly enough, the almshouse reported that he was born in New Jersey on the previous censuses, so they knew. And his parents were listed as unknown. No other information was provided about him other than the illness he died from. His body was sent to the anatomical board for, you know, use as a medical cadaver. So that's one case from our community. just to wrap it up, I just wanted to kind of give some examples of who in the later years of the almshouse might have ended up there as inmates. So we have some listings from the newspaper. The Intelligencer would as part of their weekly reporting, I guess, would have hospital notes and just list the comings and goings in a level that, like, I don't think people would think would be polite these days talking about people's medical ailments and stuff, but for historical purposes, it's fascinating. So from in October 1888 or sorry 1889, the Intelligencer listed their hospital notes. So this is just an example of what would send people to the Buck County Hospital at this time. The late arrivals at the hospital are Mrs. Fanny Brish and daughter Lucy, sent from Tinicum Township. The daughter is suffering from chronic rheumatism, and the mother, who is here to wait upon her, is also an invalid. Old Julian Davis, an old-timer and veteran of several almshouses, was brought here from Northampton County Almshouse because of his being a resident of Bucks County. Catherine E. Voorhees, a tramp sent from New Hope Borough 2 weeks ago, suffering from asthma, dropsy, and exposure, died suddenly Monday, September 23rd. An inquest was held by coroner Bidding, the jury rendering a verdict of death from heart failure. John Selp, brought here from Nockamixon last week, is a physical wreck, suffering from consumption, old age, and general debility. William Jelkis, the latest arrival, is a young German from Bristol, aged 22 years. He's in a bad way, for besides a very sore leg, he is suffering from other diseases. Eliza Griffith, who is also a great sufferer from paralysis, chronic ulcer, and softening of the brain, which would be like just a general term for dementia or cognitive decline, of late she has become entirely helpless. She is 74 years of age. So that's just kind of a random cross section of who in that month happened to be entering the almshouse. But you know, even then, it could be people from all different walks of life, whether it was alcoholism or old age or some sort of acute illness like a fever or something like that, you could end up in the Bucks County Hospital. That system, you know, up until even into the 1940 census, you still see over 100 people living there. The kind of, to wrap it up, the kind of major change that occurred that shifted us away from this was in 1937, the state passed a law kind of revising everything. In 1925, one of the reformers, cognizant of how little had changed since the Elizabethan era, before a social welfare convention urging for this type of reform, he said, our poor law legislation since 1836 has made few changes in the principles of the Elizabethan poor laws, and such slight changes as have been made have dealt almost exclusively with administrative features. Our great and progressive state, therefore, today operates substantially under the Elizabethan poor laws, which England herself discarded decades ago. So there was a push in the early 1900s as part of a larger welfare reform movement, and also obviously the Great Depression had a good bearing on this, to kind of reform things and move away from the system that we had. And so they ended up passing a state law that got rid of the county directors of the poor, placed the almshouse and similar services under the auspices of the county commissioners, from there they kind of modified stuff until it wasn't recognizable anymore. Today, the site of the almshouse, there's still a certain amount of continuity because there is the Chamonix Manor home, the retirement home, which started in the hospital building, and then in 1966, I think it was, moved to a separate building and is still a partially county-funded retirement home. There's also Grundy Hall on the former almshouse farm, which is primarily for elderly people that don't have a lot of money, but I believe 10% of the housing units in Grundy Hall are reserved for people that are somehow disabled. So even today, the county still has these facilities on the almshouse property. They're still, you know, helping take care of people that, you know, in the olden times you might have petitioned for poor relief, but now they have these residences that are provided for them. There are also a bunch of other facilities on the property once the county commissioners got hold of it, they weren't going to go buy other land to build stuff, right? So they have the county correctional facilities are there, county offices, including the planning commission, which is in the old hospital building, the health department's on that property. There are some parks I mentioned earlier on the northwest corner of the property, youth services, public safety training center, there's even one of the district courts is located there. So the old almshouse farm is still busy with government activity, but it's mostly changed in nature. All right. So I guess, does anybody have any questions?
Just one. From the Chamonix Manor that's on that property,
yeah,
that's since moved up the hill to off of 611.
Yeah.
That one is just a vacated building now.
The I believe that the new one is still on the grounds of...
It still is,
yeah,
correct.
Of the original farm.
There is a vacated one that's right next to...
That was from the 60s. Yeah.
I have one question for clarification purposes. The building that's there now, which is the Planning Commission, I'm in the Health Department, so...
Okay.
But the one now where the Planning Commission is that the old Bucks County Hospital?
Hospital.
As opposed to the
yes.
Alms House, which was torn down?
Yes.
Where was that located in proximity to the hospital?
I'll bring this back. This is the hospital.
Yeah.
That's the Alms House.
Oh, okay.
So I can walk back to the microphone here. So the hospital was right across the street from the Rodman House, that is no longer there. That I believe that's the Health Department building now that's on that site, right?
Yeah, it's sort of a flat.
Yeah, yeah. I've been there for I've been there for Health Department certification at the other. I guess it's the extension agency. I believe that the separate building there that's the Health Department is where the Alms House was.
The other question I have is, we've done these walks once a year. It's a walk thing for the county, and employees can walk all the way up around Newton to Shannon Manor and back. It's about a 1 mile walk. There's a couple of individuals from the current, we call it the Alms House building, that said there was a public hanging back there somewhere on the property.
Yeah. I believe maybe they know the location better than I do, but
no, they don't.
Okay.
My
guess is that it's I meant to print up the actual layout. Didn't get around to it. But the there we go. So it's roughly. That's Alms House Road, that's 611. I believe it was on the property, somewhere around here. I believe they mentioned that it was by the creek, which would be the Neshaminy Creek there. I think it was like 10,000 people showed up. It was like some ridiculous number of people showed up. That's a slope there, so you could have been had people all up there watching it. The story of that, that is a man named Mina, who they call the imposter, because he had some assumed identity. I think it was like Portuguese or something, I forget. But he ended up poisoning I think it was Dr. Chapman, to make off with his wife or something. And they captured him and executed him. And that was the last public execution in Bucks County.
Yeah.
And from then on, they just kept to the prison like they
what
did before
year was
that.
It? What year?
1840s, very 37. Okay, 1837. So we have the expert over here. 1837. I will note that one of the people that was interred in the Potter's Field, the old Potter's Field in Doylestown Borough, was also a man named Joseph Blunden, who was executed in the county jail, buried at the Potter's Field there, disinterred, and then buried at the Alms House. Any other questions?
Not a question, but a comment. My my great-great-great-grandmother was indentured at the age of 7 to a man in Salisbury Township. His name was Walton.
Yeah.
And that was in 1802.
Yeah, there's a lot of that back then. I've also seen one record. I believe it was a kid named Clausen who was indentured to I'm blanking on it, but the house right past the meeting house had been Rachel Frank's house, if anyone knows that. There was a boy whose father had died and his mother indentured him to him for the same reasons that one would have the overseers of the poor do the indenturing, but they just happened to do it privately. It was common whether or not it was the overseers of the poor doing it.
I don't know any of the details, but it was her father who signed the papers and everything.
Yeah, well, you know, if you have a bunch of mouths to feed and, it's the 1800s and there's no birth control, what are you going to do?
When they sold property, the belongings of a person to recoup the cost of supporting them, it sounded like that was just household effects or clothing, or could they sell actual land? I mean, I'm assuming that if people owned land, they might not be in that system.
I would guess the same thing.
Would they sell land?
I would think that it would probably be within their rights to do so. Based on the values of goods that I've seen, it was like clothing and maybe a piece of furniture or whatever. It was very minimal. Mm-hmm. By the time that you are calling on public assistance, you probably have nothing. Mm-hmm. And if you had land, maybe you would, get a tenant and part of their rent would be helping take care of you or something like that, you know. But based on the limited records that I've seen, because we got lucky that we have Wrightstown and a little bit of Solbury, but not much is out there. I've seen it from Middletown. There's one book from Middletown, but the Vendu stuff, I believe, was all from the Wrightstown book. And, we're talking less than 10 pounds mostly, I think. But they probably could. You do see, they would, for example, itemize payments that they made to the prothonotary and the sheriff as part of the settling of the estate of the deceased. And so presumably, if they're basically acting kind of as a guardian or whatever of the pauper, I would think that they would have had the right to, but I can't specifically tell you.
But you didn't happen to pick up,
no
you
land.
Say it's rather limited records then,
yeah.
So if it did happen, it might not be picked up.
It might, yes, I mean, I would say that maybe if you got really curious and started going through the sheriff sales records, maybe you could. Or vendues, which would be the term for the public auction, were publicly announced. And if you see newspaper, if you go through the newspaper announcements from that time, there would be a whole lot to go through. There are also vendue. There's some
for taxes and so on.
Yeah.
So might be more likely that than being a
public. Yeah. Well, I was going to say if you really wanted to, you could try to cross reference it. You'd be hard pressed to. Yeah. Anyone else?
With the young children, was there any kind of compensation for them? I know it's very minimal.
Room and board and a suit of clothes.
When you get a 21-year-old man,
yeah.
Then here's a jacket, see ya.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'll give you one example. Deborah Hill's son, Gov Hill, who was indentured out to Solbury when they landed at the almshouse, he ended up as a tenant farmer in Solbury. Shortly in the 1820s, shortly after his indenture would have ended, you do see him on the tax rolls for a couple of years. So like either he moved to find work or, economically just didn't make the tax rolls after that. But he's listed as an occupant renting land. And so, presumably you could make relationships with members of the community as you would if you had just been a kid that was born there and make it out on your own. Maybe, as I said before, the Sharon Salinger, who has studied, she did primarily 1700s, but Sharon Salinger, who has studied the indentured servants and different forms of bondage, slavery, as well as indentured servitude and apprenticeship, she found in studying it that the life outcomes were usually not great. In the first wave of immigration, when you had indentured servants that were primarily related to people, where you had English settlers coming over that had bought a piece of land and their nephews coming over as an indentured servant, those people ended up being well off to some extent. People that ended up doing the same thing a couple generations later when the land was already bought up and they're being indentured out to strangers, not so much. And a lot of them did end up falling on poor relief themselves, or at least never being well off enough to make it onto the tax rolls, which is an indication of economic status.
Well, how does that happen as young children? It would damage you, losing your family and everything you know, and being put in with strangers who may or may not have been kind to you.
One would think so.
Jesse, when did public welfare payments start?
I'm gonna guess sort of payments in the system that we think of now. FDR, I guess. I'm not an expert on that. What I will say is for the treatment of children specifically, one of the modernization steps of modernization they did is they went away from indenturing children out to starting a public-private partnership with the Bucks County Children's Aid Society, and they would essentially put children in foster care and pay for their upkeep instead of indenturing them out. And the county does have like disturbingly detailed records from those. If you really want to see the conditions of children in foster care down to details that you wouldn't want shared with anybody if you were those kids, you can read them in the in the county commissioner records from that time period. I've read them into, I think, into the 1920s. And basically, the commissioners would get a monthly, I think monthly, report from the Children's Aid Society about the maintenance of these children, down to, like, behavioral problems and, you know, like bedwet, like everything. so that was one way that they modernized it. But in terms of maintaining children in within the family instead of fostering, I don't really know. In the 1880 schedule that I mentioned, that has all of these nitty-gritty details, it has a separate table for homeless children, and it includes whether they've been separated from their father, their mother, whether they're illegitimate, whether they were given up by their family member. A lot of them had, you know, like a dead father, and their mother was still alive, and a lot of them were born in the almshouse. Not much more information than that is available based on what I've looked. I mean, I didn't specifically search for it, though. But, I would totally agree that would be very damaging to the children to be separated from their families. And one thing I didn't really go into that much detail about is the age range at which you could do that, basically over 2 years old. Children were not separated from their mothers when they were so young that they were deemed to be totally dependent, especially if they were still nursing. But basically above the age of two, if they were 3 years old, they could be indentured out. And, you know, the people taking care of them, you know, they were caring for them as one has to care for children, but they were also doing it with the expectation they'd get labor out of them for another, you know, 15 years. Or 20, don't want to do the math, but until age 21 if male.
A question, Mrs. Stamen. Most of the indentured servants brought over originally, they were considered slaves, as were the kids.
No.
I mean, they were treated as if.
So there are, again, going back to, if you want to read a book that's so boring that the author wrote an inscription on it saying, I hope this cures your insomnia, check out Sharon Salinger's To Serve Well and Faithfully. It's a history of bound servitude in Pennsylvania. Personally, I find it fascinating, but when I bought the book used, it had her inscription to her friend saying, I hope this cures your insomnia. Not too distracted on that. So basically, there are three classes of bound labor. There are slaves, which are the worst off. There are and have the worst life outcomes. Indentured servants, which are the next tier up, which are much better off than slaves, but still, you know, might end up in the almshouse. And then apprentices that were more likely to end up being a very skilled person afterwards. If you're apprenticed out to be a miller, for example, you're going to do okay. If you're apprenticed out. Or if you're bound out as a girl to learn the, quote, mysteries of housewifery, which is what, that's not making that up, that's what they're at, then, you know, what are you going to do afterwards? Work as a servant? Same with boys that were bound out, you know, again, you could be like a miller or something, you know, something where that was really a skilled trade, or you could be a laborer, you know, and so a lot of that had to do a lot with that, and it depended on the master. So Moses Eastburn, for example, who took in Malin Gibbs from the almshouse, he provided him with an education. A contemporary account said that he gave him as good. I should mention he was black. He got as good an education as any white child would have gotten, according to the one record, and seemed to be pretty well educated. He named one of his sons Anthony Benezet Gibbs after the Quaker, who was one of the people that pushed for the education of black children in Philadelphia. And he ended up being able to, you know, he learned how to be a lime burner, and initially being a farmer, ended up being okay, but. There were many degrees, in all of the English colonies that eventually became like slave systems, they relied on white indentured servitude first, and they also drew from the poor in England, from criminals in England. They would just pick people off the street sometimes and ship them off, and so there, you know, there was certainly some level of crossover, but there are distinctions to be had for sure.
Are the records available to research genealogy? Like often you see, there's a system that'll show you the gravestone or something.
There are a number of records. I will say that there are a number of records that I could imagine how they could be used for genealogy in terms of systematically going through them and searching by surname. Not so much because no one's indexed them.
Except for the census.
With the U.S. Census, which I'm sure, you know, that if you knew they were in the almshouse, it might be a little tricky to find it because they're actually in some years they were a separate table than Doylestown Township, and other years they were just kind of lumped in with I got the census records by knowing who the steward was and being like, okay, his household that has 100 people in it, that's the almshouse. So it's challenging, but it's there. The other records, like the poor books and stuff, no one's indexed. You'd have to just go on a fishing expedition, which I find to be particularly fun. So I can, if you have any questions about the action, how to get the sources I've talked about, I'd be happy to tell you. Most of them are from the Bucks County Historical Society, the Sports Library at the Merchant Museum, and they're, you know, in open collections. They're in collections you can access. And the government records for the almshouse are all there as well. The county repository for their old records is the Mercer Museum. They have all the ledger books that are, well, some of them I don't know where the originals are, and their records were not very well maintained, I will say, by the government before it came to the archive. And so it's pretty erratic, and stuff got shuffled around, and you know. But you also have a lot of stuff on microfilm that the state Pennsylvania Museum and Historical Commission issued that has some of the ledger books on there. Some of the original ledger books are in the basement over at in the vault there at the Historical Society. If you want any specifics, I'd be happy to tell you. I believe there's someone else from the side of the room.
Okay.
Richard.
Well, when did the almshouse action come down?
I'm thinking the date 66, but I know that was also the date that the Neshaminy Manor was separated from the hospital, so I could be conflating the two. But 1900s. There's a photograph of it from 1947 that I've seen. So.
What was the last use of it?
I do not know.
Maybe it's vacant after. You said the 40s people were still
in it. Yeah, in 1940, there's still a lot of people listed in there. Well, it's a little hard because they only a couple years they differentiated between the hospital and the almshouse. So maybe I could be wrong about that. But there were still people listed as paupers in 1940.
Thank you.
All right. Cool. If anyone has any other questions, feel free to ask me afterwards.
Thank you.